keep your hands to yourself.
City. We all make choices about alcohol. Kids make choices whether to drink or not.
Bye, Dad. Remember, I'm going to Alex's party tonight and sleeping over.
Hey, Em, remind me about that party again.
And adults make choices whether to talk about it. That's true of parents and every other trusted adult in a kid's life. Kids want to know our expectations, and they want honest answers in everyday conversations. So talk with your kids and help lead them on a positive path. Because when you talk, they hear you. Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
My name is Chris Doles. I'm here because I'm a federal worker. I'm the president of my local, IFPT Local 98, and I'm also one of the national coordinators with the Federal Unionist Network that put out a call for today's day of action in cities all over the country to stand up to the assault on the civil service.
As thousands rally against the purge underway by President Trump and Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, we'll get an update and speak with Quinn Slobidian, author of Crack Up Capitalism, about Musk's push to speed up the breakdown of the government.
I think we're seeing with DOGE right now is kind of the convergence of three sorts of forms of politics that have never been this close to power before. One is more familiar. It's kind of cost cutting, productivity, efficiency, treat the government like a business or like an asset to be stripped. Two is the more Christian conservative model of Project 2025 and the idea that you need to remove the government from certain parts of social life altogether. And the third is the more extreme version, which you could think of as a kind of right-wing accelerationism.
Then to the Democratic Republic of Congo, where the United Nations is accusing Rwanda-backed M23 fighters of killing children, attacking hospitals and warehouses storing humanitarian aid.
In the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the Congolese people have been suffering yet again from a brutal cycle of violence. And the fighting that is raging in South Kivu as a result of the continuation of the M23 offensive threatens to push the entire region over the precipice.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump has escalated his attacks on Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, describing him as a, quote, dictator without elections. Trump went on to push Zelensky to negotiate with Russia, saying he, quote, better move fast or he's not going to have a country left, unquote. This comes a day after Trump falsely accused Ukraine of starting the war. Trump also falsely said Zelensky's approval rating was down at 4% when polls show about 57% of Ukrainians support him, far higher than Trump's favorability ratings in a recent Reuters poll. Trump also falsely claimed the U.S. has supplied Ukraine with $350 billion worth of aid. In fact, government data show U.S. spending on Ukraine since 2022 has totaled about $185 billion, with 70% of the money going to U.S. weapons manufacturers here at home. On Wednesday, Zelensky responded by saying Trump's, quote, surrounded by disinformation. Trump's attacks on Zelensky have shocked many across Europe and in Washington, where even Republican lawmakers have begun to criticize Trump's shift toward Russia. Republican Senator Susan Collins said, quote, we must remember the instigator of this war was President Putin, who launched an unprovoked attack on Ukraine, unquote. Zelensky is meeting today in Kyiv with U.S. envoy Keith Kellogg. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces shot and killed three Palestinians during an overnight raid on a house in the Farah refugee camp. Elsewhere, Israeli forces shot and wounded a 15-year-old boy during a raid on the town of Beita and wounded two young men in a raid on Beit Farouk. This follows Israeli attacks on several schools operated by the UN's Palestinian Refugee Agency, UNRWA, which Israel has banned. A spokesperson for the UN Secretary General condemned the raids.
The use of tear gas and sound bombs in educational environments while students are learning is both unnecessary and unacceptable. This is a clear violation of Israel's obligation under international law.
Tens of thousands of Palestinians have fled refugee camps in the West Bank amidst Israel's offensive. This week, residents of Tul Karem camp looked on as Israeli armored bulldozers razed their homes.
I'm watching our home getting demolished, and it's one of the oldest houses in Tul Karem camp. It was suddenly wiped off the face of the earth. They wiped away all of our memories of life in that house, of all the good and not so good days, all gone. Thank God nothing will move our steadfastness on this land.
In Gaza, Hamas has returned the bodies of four hostages to Israeli authorities ahead of the planned release this weekend of six living hostages in exchange for thousands of Palestinian captives held in Israeli jails. Hamas says the four hostages were killed along with their guards by Israeli airstrikes. They include a mother and two of her children, and Oded Lifshitz, an Israeli journalist and a peace activist. Before his capture on October 7, 2023, Lifshitz volunteered with the Road to Recovery organization, which transports Palestinian children who are ill to hospitals in Israel. He once met with the late Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and previously fought a successful legal campaign to restore ancestral land to Palestinian Bedouin villagers. Israel's Knesset has approved a bill to further restrict entry to critics of Israel and its policies. Under the new law, people who deny or minimize the October 7th Hamas attacks will be refused visas. So too will people who've called for the prosecution of Israeli soldiers for war crimes or who are affiliated with groups calling to boycott, divest, or sanction Israel. On Wednesday, Israel's military said it had indicted five reservists accused of torturing a Palestinian prisoner at the notorious Tayman military base. The Association for Civil Rights in Israel reports prisoners there have routinely suffered sexual assault, beatings from guards, maulings from attack dogs, and are often made to sit on the ground blindfolded and handcuffed 24 hours a day, forbidden from moving or speaking. Meanwhile, the Gaza pediatrician, Dr. Hassam Abu Safia, has been seen in video footage for the first time since his abduction by Israeli forces outside the besieged and devastated Kamel Adwan Hospital last December, where he served as director. Video broadcast on Israeli TV appears to show Dr. Abu Safia being led by masked and helmeted guards through a prison in shackles, appearing exhausted and fatigued. In a statement, Dr. Abu Safia's family condemned the broadcast, writing, quote, "We reject any media outlet publishing the video without addressing the psychological terrorism involved in exposing the manipulation of his statements. The sight of our father shackled and unable to move should prompt immediate and continuous action to ensure his immediate release," unquote. A group of migrants recently deported from the United States are now being held in a detention camp on the outskirts of the Darien jungle in Panama. The group includes eight children and immigrants from countries including Afghanistan, China, India, Iran, Nepal, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Turkey, Uzbekistan, and Vietnam. About 200 other people deported by the U.S. are being held in a hotel in Panama where they're barred from leaving. In related news, the White House posted a video online showing a group of shackled immigrants being loaded onto a deportation flight. The video was captioned ASMR, a term that describes pleasant audio or visual stimuli. In other developments, the Trump administration has ordered legal and immigrant nonprofit groups to halt offering federally funded legal services and advice to unaccompanied migrant children. Meanwhile, the Texas Observer has identified the operator of a racist and hate-filled anti-immigrant account on the social media platform X as 44-year-old James Joseph Rodden, assistant chief counsel for Immigration and Customs Enforcement in the Dallas area. Among the account's hate-filled messages were, quote, "Migrants are all criminals," unquote. Quote, "It is our holy duty to guard against the foreign hordes," unquote. And, quote, "Nobody is proposing feeding migrants into tree shredders," unquote. In Gainesville, Texas, a funeral was held Wednesday for Jocelyn Rojo Carranza, an 11-year-old girl who died by suicide after classmates bullied her and threatened to call immigration services to deport her parents. Jocelyn was in the sixth grade. Her family said she loved playing the French horn, making TikTok videos, and swimming. New York's Metropolitan Transportation Authority has sued the Trump administration over President Trump's new order to halt New York City's congestion pricing program just 6 weeks after it began. The toll program aimed to reduce traffic in Manhattan while hoping to fund mass transit. On Wednesday, Trump wrote on Truth Social, quote, "Congestion pricing is dead. Manhattan and all of New York is saved. Long live the king." The White House's official X account then shared an image of a fake Time magazine cover of Trump wearing a golden crown, also with the headline, "Long Live the King." Separately, White House Deputy Chief of Staff Taylor Bodewich shared an AI-generated image of Trump wearing a crown and royal mantle. New York Governor Kathy Hochul responded Wednesday afternoon.
"I'm here to say New York hasn't labored under a king in over 250 years. And we are not. We sure as hell are not going to start now."
President Trump's monarchical claims, which are unprecedented in U.S. history, came a day after he signed an executive order giving himself greater power over independent regulatory agencies, which, by congressional mandate, are supposed to be shielded from interference by the chief executive. Agencies falling under Trump's order include the Consumer Product Safety Commission, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. The IRS says they'll begin firing about 6,700 workers as part of the Trump administration's sweeping efforts to gut the federal workforce. This follows a similar downsizing of the IRS during Trump's first presidential terms, when for the first time ever, working families were audited at a higher rate than households with income over $1 million. AP reports Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency is seeking access to the IRS's integrated data retrieval system, which contains sensitive taxpayer records of millions. Meanwhile, the nonprofit NGO, the International Rescue Committee, says it's laying off and furloughing thousands of workers around the world, citing, quote, the difficulty accessing funds dispersed through the U.S. government's payment system. Aid organizations say the cuts will impact programs for HIV-positive children, feeding centers for malnourished people, and water sanitation, among many others. Federal workers and labor activists around the country held a national day of action in dozens of cities Wednesday, demanding an end to mass firings ordered by President Trump and DOGE. Here in New York, protesters rallied at Federal Plaza in Lower Manhattan. Chris Doles is president of Local 98 of the International Federation of Professional and Technical Engineers.
The entire public sphere is under attack by a handful of billionaires who see an opportunity right now to smash and grab the entire civil service, take out the entire services that we provide in the process, and it's going to take a long time to put it back together if we let them break it. So we have to stop them before they get away with it.
Chris Doles will join us after headlines for more on the federal workers' pushback on Trump's cuts. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has ordered Pentagon officials to find ways to shift $50 billion in the Pentagon's current budget to help fund President Trump's priorities, including immigration operations on the southern border. While many press accounts claimed Hegseth is calling for an 8% budget cut, the Pentagon's own statements indicate the agency is just looking to realign how its $850 billion budget is spent. One official said the Pentagon will be shifting money away from, quote, so-called climate change and other woke programs, unquote. In Sudan, the Rapid Support Forces paramilitary group has announced plans to form a breakaway government 22 months after it launched a civil war against Sudan's military rulers. The conflict sparked the world's largest humanitarian crisis, with tens of thousands killed and over 12 million people uprooted from their homes. This week, the United Nations launched an appeal for $6 billion in aid to Sudan, where humanitarian groups say more than half the people have too little to eat and famine is taking hold. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the Rwanda-backed M23 fighters are marching on the eastern city of Uvira near the border with Burundi, triggering panic with residents reporting widespread looting, bodies lying in the streets and government forces commandeering boats to escape the insurgents' advance. M23 is also advancing on the city of Butembo, north of Goma, which the insurgents seized earlier this month in an offensive that killed some 3,000 people. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights has accused M23 of killing children, attacking hospitals and warehouses storing humanitarian aid. This is UNHCR spokesperson.
Our office has confirmed cases of summary execution of children by M23 after they entered the city of Bukavu last week. We're also aware that children were in possession of weapons. We call on Rwanda and M23 to ensure that human rights and international humanitarian law are respected.
UNHCR also confirmed between 10,000 and 15,000 people have fled into Burundi over the last few days. We'll have more on the escalating tensions and violence in the eastern DRC later in the broadcast. And New York Governor Kathy Hochul has deployed 3,500 members of the New York National Guard to help run state-run prisons, including Attica, after prison guards launched a wildcat strike. Prisoners are now being kept on lockdown, and many are being denied family visits, legal meetings, and religious services. Safia Elijah of the Alliance of Families for Justice said, quote, "Our family members and their incarcerated loved ones are gripped by fear of what may happen with the governor's calling in of the National Guard," unquote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Federal workers and supporters rallied in cities across the United States Wednesday to call for an end to mass firings ordered by President Trump and DOGE, the so-called Department of Government Efficiency. Their demand, SOS, Save Our Services. In just one example of the impact of the cuts, the U.S. Department of Agriculture said Tuesday it was seeking to rehire several agency employees who'd been assigned to the federal government's response to the H5N1 avian flu outbreak before their jobs were terminated as part of the Trump administration's mass firings. In a statement, the USDA said the workers were fired in error since their jobs are considered, quote, public safety positions. Here in New York, public workers held several rallies Wednesday. In a minute, we'll speak with one of the organizers. But first, this is Democratic Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez addressing workers and their supporters who gathered in the bitter cold at an SOS rally in Foley Square Wednesday night.
Elon Musk is not going after efficiency. He's not going after making these things better for people. He's trying to steal Medicaid so that he can enrich himself. He is trying to steal and gut NASA to line his pockets with SpaceX. He is trying to gut everything that is good in America for his own private profit. This is the culmination of what oligarchy is all about and what oligarchy seeks to do. It's the fusion of and the capture by the billionaire class of our democracy. That's what they're trying to do. But it's very important to understand that it is not sustainable. They may seem like they have power right now, but all of this dramatic action is trying to create the sense of inevitability, the sense of power, so that we abdicate in advance. I want everyone who is here and folks who are watching who are not here, especially our federal workers, to listen to me very carefully. Because we have very specific instructions in this moment. And I don't say this as a Democrat. I don't say this as a person with any sort of specific political views in this moment. I say this as an American who has sworn an oath to the United States Constitution. And as someone who cares about this Constitution, and who cares about this country, we have an obligation to resist kings. We have an obligation to resist oligarchs. We have a sworn duty to this nation to resist oligarchy, including any billionaire that tries to undermine our Constitution. America is not for sale.
That was Democratic Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez addressing the Save Our Services protest in Foley Square in Manhattan Wednesday night.
On Wednesday afternoon, hundreds also protested outside the Federal Building in New York City as part of the National Day of Action to support public workers being purged as part of the Trump administration's cuts under the Department of Government Efficiency led by the billionaire Elon Musk. For more, we're joined by someone who still works in the building for now. National coordinator with the Federal Unionist Network, who helped organize the Day of Action. Chris Doles works for the Army Corps of Engineers. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you talk about what's happening across the country with people getting emails at various times in the day to leave their work to that they are fired? And then in the case of nuclear safety workers, in the case of what disease detectors within the CDC, as we're dealing with an avian flu epidemic, a number of them, the government then tries to re-find them because they've cut off their government email to say, whoops, we made a mistake.
Yeah. Before I start, I need to, by government regulation, disclaim, because you mentioned my employer, that anything I say is my opinion in my personal capacity and does not reflect the views necessarily of the Army Corps of Engineers. I am the president of my local and, like you said, a coordinator with the Federal Unionist Network. They're really not after efficiency. The attacks on probationary employees is making it much, much harder for all of us who remain.
And can I just make a clarification on probationary? We're talking about hundreds of thousands of workers, and they can be people who work under 2 years, but they can also be someone who worked for 30 years, was promoted.
That's right.
Right? And that then becomes a probationary period, and they can be fired within that.
That's right. There are two categories of probationary employees: those who have just started with the federal government in the last 1 or 2 years, depending on which agency, and yes, those who were, for whatever reason, changed job series and moved to a different part of the federal government, but are otherwise longtime federal employees. I think there's a misconception that all probationary employees are, you know, recent college grads or something like that. But like myself, I started with the federal government after working for 7.5 years with a dredging contractor, and it was my dredging expertise that made me a good cost engineer for the Army Corps. The person who I spoke with last night is a lawyer who spent years in private sector and brought his legal expertise to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to help protect against fraud there. So the probationary workforce is an extremely qualified workforce in the government. And, you know, I think the fact that they're going after such high quality employees, be they probationary or not, matches up with the chaos that they're sowing, where they themselves now have to make up for the fact that they summarily fired all these people and have to go rehire them because, oh, it turns out they were doing something essential. Well, it turns out all of us are doing something not only essential, but mandated by Congress. None of us do anything that's not mandated by Congress, which of course gets at the deeper, you know, constitutional crisis element of what we're talking about here. You know, the fact that all three branches of government are on board with this really begs the question of where the checks and balances are going to come from, and that's where the federal workforce and the broader workforce and labor movement need to step in, because we're the checks and we're the balances that are going to be able to stop this before they go any further.
So, Chris, say, what is your message to other labor unions across the country?
Yeah. I mean, so we picked the slogan Save Our Services SOS on purpose, right? This is a distress signal coming from us in the federal sector. Yes, our workforce is under direct immediate attack, and a lot of the media wants to tell the human interest story about how, you know, our family lives, our lives are being disrupted. And yes, that's a story. But the bigger story, what they're really after, is to gut the services that all Americans depend on. You think about, like, how many of us depend on home health aides. You think about the subsidies to schools that come through the Department of Education. You think about Medicaid that's now on the chopping block, or veterans health care. All the essential stuff that affects our ability to live our lives, that's what they're after. Because from Elon Musk's point of view, the more miserable we are, the less likely we are to fight back. They're trying to immiserate the working class, and they're doing it through the federal workforce. It's not about efficiency. It's not about the federal workforce. It's about gutting the services that create a safety net in this country, because the more miserable we are, the easier it is for them to exploit us.
And you think, in fact, that they're going to come after private sector employees as well?
I mean, they are. They're already going after the NLRB.
Explain the National Labor Relations Board, how that connects the two.
Yeah, the National Labor Relations Board is staffed by federal workers, many of whom are active in the Federal Unionist Network alongside folks from all the agencies. And at the NLRB, their job is to uphold the right to organize, the ability to keep an abusive boss in check, all the things that allow for workers to push back against their exploitation and the abuse of management. People like Elon Musk, you know, really big bullies in their workplaces. That is enshrined by law, and it's carried out by the NLRB. And they've already pursued unprecedented attacks on that agency, and we know it's going to get worse. We know that Elon Musk has lawsuits that he's hoping to get in front of the Supreme Court soon to actually declare the NLRA, which is the act that established the NLRB, unconstitutional. So,
and do you think there's a relationship between the fact that there are complaints against Elon Musk at the NLRB and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, two of the first agencies he went after?
Totally. And the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. You know, Tesla has a financing operation that is meant to be regulated by the Consumer Financial Bureau. And go figure, the man is going after the very agencies that regulate his businesses. So we're putting out the distress signal to the broader labor movement that we all have to enter the streets, that we all have to create. They're creating the crisis. We're not the ones creating the crisis, but they think they can manage the crisis. Our job is to prove to them that it's unmanageable. And to make it unmanageable. You know, this is grand theft government. They are pursuing the biggest theft in world history, probably, given the scale that we're talking about. And it's going to be up to not just federal workers, but to the broader public, because it's the whole public sphere that's at stake. So if I can plug our, you know, the place to get involved, whether or not you're a federal worker or you just want to support the federal workforce because you see the attacks, it's go.savepublicservices.com. And there you can sign up, and we'll make sure to plug you into all the actions that are coming ahead, because this will be weeks or months, but we can stop them if we mobilize.
Chris Doles is a union organizer and Army Corps of Engineer employee, national coordinator with the Federal Unionist Network. Next up, the author of Crack Up Capitalism on Elon Musk's push to speed up the breakdown of the federal government. Stay with us. The Go-Betweens. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We look further now at the purge of the federal government underway by DOGE, led by tech billionaire Elon Musk, the richest man in the world. As protests mount, the two, Donald Trump and Elon Musk, appeared on Fox News together to defend their cuts. This is Elon Musk.
I think what we're seeing here is the thrashing of the bureaucracy as we try to restore democracy and the will of the people.
This comes as President Trump spoke at an investor conference in Miami Wednesday and floated the idea of sharing some of the savings he claims DOGE is making.
There's even under consideration a new concept where we give 20% of the DOGE savings to American citizens and 20% goes to paying down debt, because the numbers are incredible, Elon. so many billions of dollars, billions, hundreds of billions.
For more, we're joined by Quinn Slobodian, professor of international history at Boston University, author of Crack Up Capitalism. His new piece is Speed Up the Breakdown. It's about Musk's push to do that. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Professor Slobodian, if you can start off by telling us what Elon Musk is doing, this whole question over the last 2 days, what is his role? Does he run the Department of Government Efficiency that President Trump says, when questioned about it, because court papers came out that indicated he didn't, he just said, well, what counts is he's a patriot.
Yeah, I mean, I might have something to say about the patriot question later, but I think that first, I think it's helpful to kind of dispel some of the fog of war and the sort of chaotic anarchistic impressions that we're getting out of Washington these days with a sense of what the actual lineages are of the political projects we're seeing unfolding here. Because I think, and what I wrote about in the piece, is I think there's basically three somewhat distinct political projects underway here that haven't really had the chance to weave together and have the space close to power the way that they have now in the past. The first one is the idea that the government should be run like a corporation, right? There's a kind of a core Clintonite notion here that we should treat citizens like consumers. We should, you know, expose bureaucracy to the same kind of competitive pressures and kind of hallmarking and benchmarking that private companies are. And then you have to go in and sort of act like an asset stripping private equity firm and peel out all the waste and abuse and put back in sort of more efficient processes. That's how Musk sold Doge to the American people in late 2024. And that's actually why even some Democrats were on board with a Doge caucus already in December still. So there's something kind of normal about that. And there's a reason why Musk has been posting pictures of Clinton and Gore saying, hey, I'm just doing that sort of business here. But obviously, things have gone to another level. And the second, I think, strain of politics that's plugged in here is closer to that of Russell Vogt at the Office of the Management of Budget, one of the people who was critical to the Project 2025 document. And that is a more often Christian conservative sort of think tank vision of deconstructing the administrative state, not to make it more efficient and to cost cut to get to more efficiency and sort of productivity, but because you think certain things that the government has been doing are fundamentally illegitimate. So there should be no kind of redistributive role for the government. There should be no role covering things like the protection of the environment or the provision of special education or the provision of sort of projects towards gender equity, anti-racism, and things of that nature. So the idea there is you permanently sort of hobble the Leviathan of the state and, you know, hack back some of its capacity, send that back to the states, and produce a government that governs intensively but not extensively. So, you know, border, military budget, maybe federal abortion bans, but all the other sort of post-civil rights, great society programs get sort of permanently euthanized. The third strain, though, that sort of gets to some of the more extreme dynamics that people have been picking up on is what I think you can call right-wing accelerationism. So this is a kind of very online ideology often associated with people like Curtis Yarvin and Nick Land. And there the idea is that you don't just sort of trim the state or kind of streamline it, but you shatter it all together. And so there's a vision of total decentralization of sovereignty back to smaller kind of fortified private enclaves, turning the United States into a kind of a patchwork of fiefdoms or sovcorps, as Yarvin calls them, where people are sort of, you know, opting in, paying to get into gated communities, and then sort of in zero-sum social Darwinist competition with the world beyond them. And that's quite sci-fi and kind of speculative. But at times, I think that the sort of sense of panic that we feel is people wondering whether you can just delete all of the kind of capacities of the state and expect to be able to plug them back in at any level afterwards, or if there is a kind of irreversible process of dismantlement happening here.
And so, Professor Slobodian, we'll get to Curtis Yarvin in a minute, whom you mentioned. But if you could elaborate on some of the ideological precursors to these three strains you identify. I mean, you mentioned in the second, for example, deconstructing the administrative state. We heard that first from Steve Bannon. So if you could, you know, elaborate on where these strains are coming from within the American political tradition, most recently, you know, the last Trump administration, but also prior to that.
Yeah, I mean, many of these things that we think of as kind of natural parts of the way the U.S. government operates, for example, something like income tax, are actually just over 100 years old. So the idea of having a federal government that oversees many parts of social life is actually, you know, it's only a few generations in the past. And there are conservatives who see that as a kind of a project of decline. So famous examples would be someone like James Burnham, who wrote about what he called a managerial revolution. So there was this fear that, you know, that the kind of the essence of American enterprise was being strangled because there were just all of these civil servants producing a kind of a sclerotic layer over the economy and pursuing their own kind of ideological projects. So Russell Vought at OMB talks about what he calls the woke and weaponized bureaucracy. He talks about almost complete Marxist takeover of the government. So this isn't really that much of a sort of neoliberal economic way of thinking. It's this belief that the state is a kind of a battlefield for opposing ideologies. And that's been, you know, pretty consistent on the American right and is now, and certainly was informing Steve Bannon's more cultural and political idea of the kind of wars that need to be fought inside of bureaucracy and indeed outside of it.
And can you talk about that battle right now between Bannon and Elon Musk and who, in fact, is winning? He's been talking about vowing to get Elon Musk kicked out, just said he's a truly evil guy, a very bad guy, and most recently referred to him as a parasitic illegal immigrant. Talk more about these two strains.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, this really flared up, obviously, at the end of last year with the debate about immigration, with the sort of Musk, Vivek Ramaswamy, Silicon Valley wing defending temporary visas, so-called H-1B visas, for their sector because they need a lot of skilled workers kind of in the back office. And then Bannon saying that that was itself unpatriotic and there needed to be American jobs for American native workers policy and a much more complete kind of exclusion of you know, new incoming workers. What was interesting is that got extremely heated. I mean, as you say, Bannon has been not holding back at all in the way he's been describing Silicon Valley as an apartheid state. He's even using categories that are more common on the left, like calling it techno-feudalism, and claiming that like the bayonets are out and he's advancing and he's coming for Musk. But what's symptomatic and interesting there is the way that Trump has sort of kept aloof from the whole conflict, right? I think that he is probably instinctively seeing that you don't actually need to choose a side. Actually, you can accommodate, and you will, I think, and are accommodating both sides of this apparent schism inside of the big MAGA coalition. So there's no reason why the kind of hard border nativists can't get the kind of sadistic roundups that, you know, we're talking about at the top of the program, can't produce terror in the lives of young people in the way that they are doing so effectively, that will fulfill the kind of libidinal sadistic desires of a certain sector of the MAGA coalition, even as, you know, more quietly you keep doing more pragmatic immigration policy to, you know, fill out the programmers in the back offices of Silicon Valley. I think that more likely than not, we're going to get a mixture of both. And as to who gets closest to Trump's ear, I mean, the answer, I think, is in the bank accounts. There are 500 billion reasons why Trump is going to listen to Musk more than he's going to listen to Bannon. And Trump is a person who doesn't believe in much, but he believes in money. And he doesn't trust many people, but he trusts people who are richer than him. And Musk's ability to kind of, you know, stroll through the White House as if he has been elected himself, have his three-year-old sort of like muttering to Trump in the middle of a press conference, I think it gives us as much evidence as we need of the fact that he is being given kind of carte blanche here to act as effectively unelected co-president.
Well, let's go back to Curtis Yarvin, who you mentioned earlier. This is Yarvin speaking on the New York Times podcast, The Interview, last month. In this clip, he's asked about his belief that the Civil War and the end of chattel slavery were bad for the formerly enslaved.
But are you seriously arguing that that the era of slavery was somehow better than the era?
The era of 1865 to 1875 was absolutely, and the war itself wasn't good either. But if you look at the living conditions for an African American in the South, they are absolutely at their nadir between 1865 and 1875. They are very, very bad because basically this economic system has been disrupted.
But abolition was a necessary step to get through that period towards to make people free.
Sure.
Like, I can't believe I'm arguing
Brazil abolished slavery in the 1880s without a civil war.
So that was Curtis Yarvin, someone who Vice President J.D. Vance frequently invokes. And back in 2021, Vance, then an Ohio candidate for U.S. Senate, he was interviewed by the conservative Jack Murphy Live podcast. Murphy just asked Vance how to root out wokeism from American institutions.
There's this guy, Curtis Yarvin, who's written about some of these things. And so one is to basically accept that this entire thing is going to fall in on itself, right? I tend to think that we should seize the institutions of the left and turn them against the left, right? We need like a de-bathification program, but like a de-wokeification program in the United States, right?
So if you could tell us, Professor Slobodian, who is Curtis Yarvin? You note in your recent New York Review of Books piece, his idea, this is quote, his idea of rage, retire all government employees, looks a lot like that of Doge. So who is this guy? Where did he emerge from? And how did he become so influential?
Yeah, I mean, he was someone who moved to the Bay Area and became a computer programmer, also kind of an amateur poet, and I guess most importantly, a pretty widely read blogger in the 2000s, especially the late 2000s, under the name Mencius Moldbug. And he became someone who was kind of giving voice to a nascent kind of what was called neo-reactionary or dark enlightenment sentiment in Silicon Valley, which I think combines, as the way I've been describing it, a kind of belief in economistic bottom line thinking and productivity, but then also an idea that what we need to get back to is a proper sense of hierarchy in this country and in the world. So one of the problems of the administrative state is that it has been pursuing equality, and it's been working under the false assumption that all humans are somehow equal. That in fact, there are kind of hierarchies of intelligence best measured in IQ, which people like Yarvin and increasingly Vance and Trump are seemingly quite obsessed with. It can be measured in things like race. Group differences in IQ are, you know, commonly assumed to be real empirical facts in the world of the sort of Silicon Valley right. And perhaps most importantly, into hierarchies of gender. So the masculinity component in all of this is kind of impossible to overstate. There is a reason why the sort of apparent scrambling of gender in gender queer and trans movements is so triggering and so terrifying to people in this world. Elon Musk has described the woke mind virus as having killed his child, even though his child is very much alive. So the project, I think, is really about how through the mechanisms of the market and the dismantlement of the sort of post-New Deal state, the post-Great Society and civil rights state, we can get back to what they see as a more natural world where men are in charge, white people are in charge, and there is a kind of restoration of the natural order of things. And that sort of wishy-washy treatment of things like slavery is a sort of a provocative way of reopening those questions.
And Professor Slobodian, this is about both J.D. Vance and Elon Musk, the question of their stance on the far-right German party AfD. On Friday, Vice President J.D. Vance gave a speech at the Munich Security Conference where he repeatedly attacked Europe on a number of issues. And he, while in Germany, held a 30-minute meeting Friday with the head of Germany's far-right AfD party, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz rebuking Vance for meeting with the AfD ahead of Germany's election. And of course, you have Elon Musk repeatedly using his social media platform X to support what many call the neo-Nazi party or the Nazi curious party, for those who are more generous.
Yeah, I mean, the AfD in Germany is actually a really good example of one of these sort of strange bedfellow type parties that I actually think is sort of unhelpfully described as either neo-Nazi or Nazi curious. What it actually is it was founded by ordo-liberal economics professors who disliked the way Merkel was handling the Eurozone crisis and thought you needed more monetary discipline and more fiscal discipline. They then created an alliance with basically ethno-nationalists, traditionalist members of the so-called New Right, who felt that modernity had produced a fallen world and we needed to get back to more rooted links to the land, and that certain populations belonged in some spaces and not others. And then now they have created this kind of this far-right neoliberal party that Alice Weidel sort of gives voice to when she says that, you know, we are actually a libertarian conservative party, as she said in her Spaces chat with Musk. The AfD is one of only many far-right parties that now Musk is aggressively platforming. In the last few days, he's promoted Viktor Orban, Giorgio Meloni, the AfD, and in the past has gone as far as promoting Tommy Robinson, the sort of far-right figure from the UK. He has adopted not just sort of a tame language of democracy, as Vance tends to be using, but a language, as he used in the rally that he zoomed into, of Germany for the Germans, and saying that multiculturalism must not be allowed to dilute the German people. So these are now proper tropes of the far right as such, and indeed tropes of the great replacement theory, which suggests that liberals have used welfare policy and refugee policy to buy voters, which can then swamp and dilute the native population. This has now become a common talking point. The thing that I think is interesting and important, and perhaps a sign of rare optimism these days, is that Germans actually don't like Elon Musk interfering in their politics. Polls have showed that of non-AfD voters, you know, well over three quarters thinks he has no right to butt in. And even among AfD voters, only about half actually wants him to be involved. So I think what we're seeing already is a bit of a backlash against his attempt to kind of, you know, play kingmaker in countries, another country that is not his own. The left party in Germany has had a surge in recent weeks. They have more people entering the party now than they have since 2009. That's partially on the back of like a really full-throated anti-fascist call for the defense of democratic principles by the young leaders, the young female leaders of that party. So I think there is a chance here of his belief that he can just, you know, play puppet master globally, actually having a boomerang effect and backlashing on his own attempts at manipulation.
Quinn Slobodian, we want to thank you for being with us, professor of international history at Boston University, author of Crack Up Capitalism, Market Radicals, and the Dream of a World Without Democracy. We'll also link to your New York Review of Books headlined Speed Up the Breakdown. When we come back, an update on the Democratic Republic of Congo. Stay with us.
Tout ce sang des crises et des pleurs. Y en a marre de toutes ces guerres. Que faisons-nous de toutes ces terres? Un champ de bataille propice pour des meurtres. Au nom de quoi on doit subir tout ça? Il est temps de mettre fin à ce carnage. Tout ce en quoi je crois se résume pas à ça. Tous les jours des familles plient bagages. Tole limingio, pardon et coquille. Tosengi kimiao.
Amani, which means peace, by the Congolese singer Oliverman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to the Democratic Republic of Congo, where the Rwanda-backed M23 armed group has taken vast areas of the eastern DRC and is marching on the strategic city of Uvira near the border with Burundi, triggering panic, with residents reporting widespread looting, bodies lying in the streets, and government forces commandeering boats to escape the insurgents' advance. M23 is also advancing on the city of Butembo, north of Goma, which the armed group seized in January in an offensive that killed some 3,000 people. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights has accused M23 of killing children and attacking hospitals and warehouses storing humanitarian aid, and says as many as 15,000 people have fled into Burundi in recent days. On Wednesday, the Congolese foreign minister addressed the UN Security Council.
We are looking for a political solution and we're committed to it. The problem that we have is that despite the commitments that Rwanda, or the lip service that Rwanda serves to the cause of a political solution, when we look on the ground, we see desolation. We see the constant advance of the M23. We see executions of children, as reported by the OHCHR yesterday. And we see that Rwanda is not being faithful or keeping their words and not being sincere in engaging in a political solution.
In an interview with CNN earlier this month, Rwandan President Paul Kagame claimed he was unaware of any Rwandan military troops fighting in the eastern DRC.
Today, on the 3rd of February, does Rwanda currently have any troops at all in eastern DRC?
I don't know.
You're the commander-in-chief.
Yeah. There are many things I don't know.
That was Kagame, the president of Rwanda, being interviewed by CNN's Larry Madowo. For more, we're joined by the Congolese analyst and activist Kambale Musavuli, who's now based in Accra, Ghana, policy analyst with the Center for Research on the Congo-Kinshasa. And his latest piece for People's Dispatch, headlined "The Battle for Control of Goma Continues." Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Kambale. It's great to have you with us again this week, but under horrible circumstances. Explain the situation in the Democratic Republic of Congo for people who are not aware of what is happening, how dire it is, and what you think needs to happen.
Since the beginning of the year, we've had over 500,000 people who have been displaced in the east, added to the 6 million already displaced in the country. And this is caused by the uprising of the M23. It's a militia group that has existed in the Congo under different names. And this is their latest uprising, as they're taking over town after town. Killings are taking place. For example, for the city of Goma, at least 3,000 people have been killed in the city during the battle of taking over Goma. And just yesterday, we're finding out more information about the taking over of the city of Bukavu. But this battle, which has been raging for close to 30 years, is always about the control of Congo's mineral wealth. Congolese are paying the price as the world needs Congo's resources. Unfortunately, strong actions are not being taken to bring about peace and stability in the Congo, and we know what needs to happen. You know, international pressure on Rwanda and Uganda, to some extent, will bring about peace and stability. It was done in 2012. It's not being done now.
So, Kambale, can you explain why you think that's the case? The last time you were on the show, you said the same thing, as indeed in an opinion piece in the New York Times that appeared yesterday. Nobel laureate Denis Mukwege, a Congolese Nobel laureate, peace laureate, made exactly the same argument. So what is the difference between 2012 and now?
There seems to be, in my view, a geopolitical consideration from Western countries who benefit from Congo's resources. If you look at an article that came out just last month from Sky News, the reporter was analyzing the European Union. The European Union has an agreement with Rwanda on getting access to critical minerals, and they are refusing to cancel that agreement when we all know that minerals being sold by Rwanda in the quantity that it's doing is actually coming from the DRC. The consideration for the European Union is that by canceling this contract, it will give ways to Russia and China getting access to mineral resources, clearly telling us that the lives of the millions of Congolese do not matter. That's on one level the reason why there is no action. The other one is the world apathy. The information being accessible or available on the DRC is there, even African nations are not taking the necessary actions for that. So this is an appeal for ordinary citizens that we are saying that we can talk about the fourth industrial revolution with Congo's resources, but we should not have blood in the technology devices that we are using. So it's up to the citizens in the biggest metropolitan, the United States, that's benefiting from the pilfering of Congo's resources, European nations, and including the UK. World pressure of ordinary citizens is going to support the Congolese in the struggle to bring about peace and stability.
I wanted to ask you about the West's support for Rwanda. This goes to a number of issues. We just spoke to you a few days ago about the Oscar-nominated documentary soundtrack to a coup d'etat, about what the U.S. did in with its involvement in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, the first independence leader of modern-day Congo, and using black jazz musicians in the United States in cementing the U.S. relationship and trying to get access to all the rare metals. Now I wanted to come here to 2025. Earlier this month, DRC's foreign minister urged three football clubs, Arsenal, Bayern Munich, and Paris Saint-Germain, to end their, quote, bloodstained sponsorship agreements with Visit Rwanda, questioning the morality of such partnerships. Just today, Reuters reports Rwanda has described this criticism as a threat to regional peace and security. Meanwhile, the musician John Legend is scheduled to headline Global Citizens Move Africa Tour and play in Kigali, the Rwandan capital, on Friday. The Nigerian Grammy-winning singer Tems recently canceled her appearance, saying, quote, "So I recently promoted my show in Rwanda without realizing that there's ongoing conflict between Rwanda and Congo. I never, ever intend to be insensitive to real-world issues, and I sincerely apologize if this came across that way. I simply had no idea this was going on. My heart goes out to those affected. Conflict is no joke, and I truly hope and pray for peace in this time." If you can talk about both the concert, John Legend participating, but of course the bigger issue, also the sports teams, all this Western support for Rwanda and how it's furthered the conflict in Congo.
This is a form of soft power that these institutions and individuals are doing. I mean, John Legend going to Rwanda in the midst of 3,000 people being killed, children being recruited by militia groups. And it's not that he's not aware. There have been a campaign for close to 2 months now, letting him know that he should not attend. Tems took action. So all the people who support him, he's not the only one. Dave Chappelle traveled to Kigali and took a picture with Paul Kagame. You have even Kendrick Lamar, who was just headlining at the NFL. Had a concert in Kigali, and at the end of the concert, he was on stage with Paul Kagame. So when people in the United States watch the news and see Kendrick Lamar, see John Legend, see Dave Chappelle with Paul Kagame, and the usual people, you had Tim Cook for Apple also with him, it creates an image that this is a great leader, a non-criminal leader, who's helping his country. So it's a form of soft power to actually cover that. And we have to expose it. Now, this, as you pointed out in the film, Central to a Coup d'Etat, showed that in the past, the State Department and CIA used artists as a ploy for soft power. Right now, the same thing is happening. I think that should be exposed. It's critical for ordinary people to challenge them. Even to go to the NBA. I mean, the NBA Africa, they are lobbying to engage on the African continent. On the day of the All-Stars, there was a protest outside of the All-Stars game where ordinary Americans were saying the NBA has blood in its hands for collaborating with Rwanda. So we have to expose all these contradictions, but we must not forget that this battle is very dire. People are being killed on a daily basis. Congo's territorial integrity is affected. The Congolese have called for Rwandan troops to leave, and all of us around the world, we have to do everything in our power to join the Free Congo campaign to put pressure on Rwanda and any negative forces so that Congolese can have a chance to change the country.
Kambale Musavuli, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Congolese analyst and activist now based in Accra, Ghana. Policy analyst with the Center for Research on the Congo Kinshasa. We'll link to your piece in People's Dispatch. It's headlined, "The Battle for Control of Goma Continues." To see our extended interview with Kambale from a few days ago, you can go to democracynow.org, as well as a full interview with the director of the Oscar-nominated film Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat that includes a number of clips of this documentary about U.S. involvement, Belgian involvement with the assassination of the Congolese independence leader Patrice Lumumba, and how the U.S. State Department deployed black jazz musicians who would later revolt against what they had done in Congo by protesting at the U.N. General Assembly after Lumumba was killed, shouting assassin and murderer. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Hi, I'm Melinda Crawford, a Scottish fiddler, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Imagine home. The smell of coffee, the sound of a lawnmower, the sun's warmth on your face. Free to be yourself, surrounded by love that helps you grow. This is a place to call home. That's an American dream we all deserve. But in 50% of U.S. states, you could legally be denied housing if you are LGBTQ+. Get the facts and hear real stories at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
Hey, look, everyone, it's Mando.
Everybody ready?
Well, hello there, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of Whiskey Before Breakfast Radio, or the Roots Program, depending on where you are located. I am Mando Richard, and I'm joined today by Abriana, who is a trainee here at WRCT Pittsburgh. She's going to have a show here soon, too. Anyway, what do we got lined up for you? Well, we've got a liquored up set as usual. We've got a folk rock set in the middle of the show, and we've got our gospel set at the end of the show. And so I don't have to make any of the CDs go to 78 RPM. Let's get things started. Here comes a wacky one from Elton Mischow. It's called Bar Exam.
Bar exam. Well, if the
out on the dance floor with a drink in each hand. She knew every song from Kid to Merle. She was dancing with me and dancing with girls. That's when I knew she passed.